Okay, so my paper title has changed. It's now Australian Deceptions, Some Definitions of Craft. My paper focuses on different kinds of craft in the context of white settlement and Australian poetry, with examples of related problems and poems. Though I'll make some reference to the unsettled, I'll leave aside the problem of context as a term, just noting that it implies settlement also, its etymology, including such notions as continuity and the unbroken. It might be said to be crying out for deconstruction via Derrida's term difference, which, as he writes, is the subversion of every realm. This is obviously what makes it threatening and necessarily dreaded by everything in us that desires a realm. Context etymology involves craft also, through such terms as weaving, joining and putting together. We might think here of the Jindiwarabak's proposed annexing of the indigenous settler, but let this remain an aside. Writing of American literature, English critic David Hurd draws a connection between settlement and fanaticism. He claims that it is a feature of Moby Dick that just when everything seems like it might settle down, somebody, somewhere, starts to rant and rave. He quotes from Melville's novel, "Nor is the history of fanatics half so striking in respect to the measureless self-deception of the fanatic himself as his measureless power of deceiving others." Hurd adds that the novel is predicated on the history of fanatics. The novel's context is that of religious enthusiasts. Locally, Katrina Schlunker asserts that the invasion or settling of Australia, the coming of whites, was not represented as one colour meeting another, but rather the coming of a metaphorical light, which was variously called massacre, invasion, civilization, and sometimes religion. I note that the etymology of religion also implies settlement through the Latin root of ligare, to tie, to bind, fasten, while fanatic merely suggests belonging to a temple, fanum, its derogatory use suggesting religious prejudice. The term settlement was a euphemism, even in the British colonisers' country. Raymond Williams writes, for example, of the enforced settlement of the poor in England. Hurd's quote refers to what might seem the paradoxical notion of settling on the sea. It can also be read as referring to craft in the senses of deception and of the boat, a type of craft, as the place or means of settlement. Firstly, deception, craft in the sense of craftiness. Melville refers to both self-deception and the deceiving of others, and both are crucial aspects of the context of writing in Australia. Australia was, of course, founded on the settler self-deception of Terra Nullius, a theory that had devastating consequences for the people already living here. Etymological roots of deception include take and seize. If we refer to the American writer Ralph Waldo Emerson, deception is just another word for politics. Every actual state is corrupt. What satire on government can equal the severity of censure conveyed in the word politic, which now for ages has signified cunning, intimating that the state is a trick, he writes. Emerson also notes in poetic form that fear, craft, and avarice cannot rear a state. Contemporary American critic Frank Lentricchia paraphrases Foucault's argument in Madness Civilization that the cunning achievement of all such cultural systems, for example, the hôpital général, is that they assign natural being to those inside their versions of truth and monsterhood to those outside. A key colonial deception is related to writing, as Stephen Mukey notes. The fact that Aboriginal writing systems did not record the sounds of language enabled the colonisers to assume that there was no writing at all, whereas in fact, this writing resembled a writing system like Chinese. The colonisers' assumptions was that alphabetic script was the only real form of writing. Mukey here undoes the opposition of indigenous equals oral, settler equals scriptural. Both Indigenous and settler writing have an oral and chirographic, that is, handwritten history, both pre- and post-contact. Deceit is sometimes a matter of survival. In Benjo Patterson's Waltzing Matilda, the jolly swagman's failure to deceive the troopers leads him to trying the ultimate trick of drowning himself to evade them. Or consider Gwen Harwood's mother, a character of In the Park, who says one thing about motherhood to an ex-lover and another to the wind. Another form of deception is the hoax, such as Harwood's abusive acrostic sonnets, a hoax that failed with Meanjin but succeeded with the bulletin editors, and one which ultimately, and a different hoax, which ultimately, like the narrative of Waltzing Matilda, involved the police, the Ern Malley hoax, in deceiving angry Penguins editor Max Harris with their fake poet and his faked Irv. James McCauley and Harold Stewart wanted to prove their hypothesis that Harris, the editor, might, like a surrealist, be fooling himself all the time. This was, of course, a highly reactionary project, buying into the notion that modernism fooled the public, and also that Australian literature should not fool itself into being continental European, but should remain sensibly in the English tradition. This is, I would argue, the greater deception, that Australian literature was English, as if Australia itself was merely subject matter. There are other deceptions that are more insidious. Charles Harper's early poem, To the Lyre of Australia, begins, "Lyre of my country, remains it for me, from the charm muttering savages, rude beating hand, to snatch thee." While the title of Dorothea McKellar's popular My Country claims the country with the title, it was originally titled Core of My Heart, her use of the present tense throughout negates its history and thereby justifies her enactment of Indigenous displacement. The American poet John Ashbery has likened writing poetry to watching TV, saying, "There's always something on, in the mind, that is." Ashbery's image here is the opposite of craft and suggests that thinking itself is a somewhat passive occupation. It is the TV rather than the camera, for example, that thinks. What anthropologist Eric Michaels refers to as the Aboriginal invention of TV suggests a different conception of thinking or reading in relation to television, as well as new perceptions of Australia's so-called emptiness. Michaels reports on Yundamu videomaker Francis Duparula's videos of the local Central Australian landscape. He quotes Duparula on that camera's movement. "This is where the police trackers come over the hill. That is the direction the ancestors come in from, and includes a tree where spirits live, or a flower with symbolic value." Michaels makes it clear that for the Walpuri, land that is perceived to have history is not empty. TV itself, as an act of reading, is shown to have memory, a past, as well as a present and future, unlike Ashbery's parodic permanent present. According to ecological theorist Timothy Morton, we've lost a sense of the significance of events that appear on horizons, adding, "Did we ever have them?" Morton's "we" here appears to be an abbreviation for Western. According to Morton, there is only one perspective, and that a lost or negative one. He gives us his example, the lost ability to read the light of different stars, as an example, though many Australians might think of the appearance of smoke. Reading stars and constellations are the original distant reading. The term constellation verges on metaphor and relies on a perspective of a group of stars seen from Earth. Constellation as a metaphor is one that recurs throughout the poetics of Stéphane Mallarmé. His influential poem, Un coup de day, is referred to as black printed stars on a white page sky. This distance from the stars is emphasised by Emerson, who writes, "If a man would be alone, let him look at the stars." Yet elsewhere, Emerson refers to stars differently. They bless us. They bless us. Stars are almost spiritual. The virtuous man finds brotherhood in the stars. Following Christian tradition, stars also stand for something good in Milton. and banally enough seem far away in poems of Yeats and many others, of course. In Gagaju poet Bill Nagy, however, stars are not just images, but implicated in the cosmological story of feeling. Stars, he says, like trees, work with and for us. There is a sense of interconnected care that is distinct from Mallarmé, and different also, yet not completely, from Emerson. In a much cited passage of The Origin of the Work of Art, Martin Heidegger refers to a painting by Van Gogh of a pair of peasant shoes set against a background of undefined space. His main point is that the painting is techné, which in his etymology means not craft or technique, but a mode of knowing, a bringing into the light, unconcealedness, what the Greeks called aletheia. Heidegger opposes, then, the deceptive nature of craft by defining painting as knowing and by giving an example of an apparently visually contextless object. Yet shoes and space define each other, are relational. As Canadian critic Steve McCaffrey writes, form is essentially dialogic. Is dialogue, is form then, deceptive? The form of any portion of matter, whether it be living or dead, writes Darcy Thompson, may in all cases alike be described as due to the action of force. In short, the form of an object is a diagram of forces. Thompson suggests that from an object's form we can deduce the forces that have acted upon it. French theorist Gerard Genet quotes the poet Paul Eluard as saying, poems always have great white margins, great margins of silence. Genet adds that the suppression of punctuation in much modern poetry has a similar effect, obliterating grammatical relations and making the poem pure verbal constellation in the tradition of Mallarmé. What forces diagram this whiteness? Each formulation of whiteness and constellation attempts a conceptualization of purity that seems strained at best. In a reading of the influential concrete poem Silencio by Eugen Gomringer, Craig Saper writes, instead of repeating words describing a pre-existing blank silence, the poem also demonstrates that our concept of silence as blank space arises only from the surrounding words. Silence is born after writing. This interpretation does require our engagement with the design of the poem, which no longer mimetically illustrates the simple and banal idea that silence equals blank space. Concrete poetry takes the syntactical to the meta or hyper-relative level. According to Geraldo de Campos, the Brazilian poet, concrete poetry eschews all notions of craft in favour of industrial techniques of production. In a nuanced treatment of human relation and definition, Australian poet and critic Faze Wiki writes that the desert acts as a place of definition. Man is homeless in its shadeless indifference, a wanderer who owns only what he needs, not what he thinks he ought to possess. The nomadic tradition discernible in the biblical record of Exodus must have played a considerable part in the act of choice of a life in such humanly inhospitable regions. Historical factors that add further dimensions of meaning to the desert as a symbol of freedom from the burden of property. The desert then comes first and forms the human. Zwicky argues further, and somewhat paradoxically, that the concerns of Australian literature have always appeared as essentially solitary, inward-turning, never outer-directed. The babble of speech masking a dumb void, a landscape without a recognisable human being in it. Yet as the title of a recent book featuring the art of Jimmy Pike announces, they call it the desert, but we used to live there. Printed words and letters are not black if we consider the spaces within them and the spaces around them. The whiteness of a page or conceptual screen page is a part of word definition. Like constellations, letters and words must be both together and apart to be readable. If we make a mark on a blank piece of paper, does the mark mean something, or does it make the page mean something? It may seem like a reductive comparison, regardless, to compare the page to the land, which is never blank, never not alive. A page, too, always has properties, but perhaps not the conceptual page, book, or desert. To switch metaphors, letters and words contain pools or billabongs and are defined by their surrounding waters. Craft is another word for boat. Travel to and around the borders of islands such as Australia requires boats. And boats are not just transport, but are involved in both war and taking and seizing and drowning. Most drownings in Australia are inland. Of the 284 drownings of Australians in 2012, 55 were watercraft related. Yet those figures don't take into account the over 300 asylum seekers who drowned attempting to reach Australian land. Roland Barthes writes that the image of the ship may well be a symbol of departure. It is, at a deeper level, the emblem of closure. Drowning is part of Australian reality and its imaginary. Two of the best-known poems produced by Settler Australia feature drowning: Waltzing Matilda, which has an inland drowning as its climax, and Kenneth Slessor's Five Bells, Elegy to a Friend, an elegy to a friend who drowned from a ferry in Sydney Harbour. Boats can also be crafty in the sense of deceptive. In his poem The Stunned Mullet, titled after a vernacular expression, John Forbes compares the fake scales of a submarine posing as a fish to this deception involved in the cunning mechanical contrivance of former Prime Minister Bob Hawke's hair. The fish is stunned from the impact of the shore, while presumably Hawke's deceiving, not quite mullet, is stunned by hair product. The poem's second person is positioned between the submarine and an airship belonging to entrepreneur Alan Bond above. The submarine is steered by Jules Verne's Captain Nemo. Nemo in Latin meaning nobody, but in Greek it means give what is due and also pasture, and in this form is the root of nomad. There is a song by Nyala Stockman, Mirinyi Mirinyi Mara Jinkari, called Wariranya Is Not Your Country Any Longer. It is addressed to sheep that are being taken on a boat to Port Hedland, Western Australia, to be slaughtered. Wariranya is not your country any longer. You are headed for your graveyard. The ship is just a morbid vehicle in this song, but in another by Jinkari, a ship is itself described as being homesick and blowing his whistle. Contrast the difficulty of stepping onto Australian land or becoming Australian for asylum seekers with this 1887 quote from the Bulletin. All white men who come to these shores with a clean record and who leave behind them the memory of the class distinctions and the religious differences of the old are Australian. In this regard, all men who leave the tyrant-ridden lands of Europe for freedom of speech and right of personal liberty are Australians before they set foot on the ship that brings them hither. No nigger, no Chinaman, no Lascar, no Kanaka, no purveyor of cheap coloured labour is an Australian. In several poems in Anya Volks's book Boat, which has little punctuation or silence, a boat is not an image, but a word, a place, and a self. It is made of paper or a book. It comes into the head or is somewhere to live. Yet there is no settling or Heideggerian dwelling here, but constant action and mutation. There appears to be no crafting as such either, but rather instant making. Boats become hats, become boats, become heads. The narrator sails away as a self-made it, I. Volvics parodies the instruction to always wear a hat, as if a hat saves the wearer from drowning and keeps their head afloat. In the conclusion to the poem Boat Hat, the making becomes implicated in health and royal feeling. Balance even keel, thinks clear king. I stick my tongue out, I wear a gold boat hat on my head, even head. Glad, mighty fine, I'm feeling very well, thank you now. I make 10 boats hats to wear, I have to have 10 boat hats to have a hat boat to wear to keep head together. I make 10 boats hats for every weather, inner to wear hats to show how head is. How is my head now? What hat are you going to wear? How's my head? My head now's how'd my head today, dear? How are you? In Volvics's mode, there is no crafting of sentence or line. The poems are exercised in syntactic cunning. in boat, hat, shifting suddenly from first to second person and turning the affect up. It could be described as an exercise of strength also, to refer to the Old Norse equivalent of craft, crafter, which makes a perhaps parodic link with Harold Bloom's theory of the strong poet. The poem comes into existence in the flow of syntax with the poet as boat and boat carrier. As a poetry or creative writing metaphor, craft seems like a settled and settling term, evoking a settled practice around the poem's object and counter to models that are more spontaneous or processoral. Craft suggests making things that are useful and or decorative. Two ostensibly useful, but perhaps ultimately decorative, iconic settler objects come to mind. The billy or billy can, which in Waltzing Matilda fails to boil water. And bushranger Ned Kelly's armour. Both are metal, both, like boomerangs, are improvised for and from living outdoors. This makes them unsettled objects. They are not used by the literally settled, though they are made from settler materials. Rather, they are used by swagmen on the wallaby or track and bushrangers on the run. Though I don't mean to valorise them merely for this, there is a bush improvised poetics to this crafting, which is a form of assemblage, or equally bricolage, which we can read non-Indigenous poetics through. Anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss distinguishes bricolage from craft, referring to a bricoleur as someone who works with his hands and uses devious means compared to those of a craftsman. This kind of craft could also be called secondary or recycling or conceptual, as is the making of further things from things already made. It returns the industrial product to a handmade process, yet in the Australian imaginary, these objects arguably displace others. Where once the crafting of boomerangs, spears, woomeras and so on were directly related to survival through hunting, now the survival is mediated through the market. An Australian government initiative, the Cooperative Research Centre for Remote Economic Participation, is a research centre delivering solutions to economic disadvantage in remote Australia. On the page related to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander art economies, the word craft is mentioned frequently, but only as a secondary term paired with art. The terms are not defined, although there is a photo. I think they're goannas, I'm guessing. I'm not sure, though. Here's a list of syntactical contexts. Art and craft sector, arts and crafts enterprises, creation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander arts and art and crafts, variability of art and craft provenance, quality and supply, arts and crafts industry across remote Australia, arts and crafts sector stakeholders, art and craft product diversification, greater diversity of art and craft products created for sale. Craft is a word functions primarily as an adjective in this context, and this is generally true of, for example, the Australia Council's Visual Arts and Crafts Strategy Evaluation Report from 2010. There again, the word craft is mostly paired with the word art, except in reference to craft organisations and one reference to crafted design. Literature is a separate topic, as is Indigenous. In settler culture, the term craft also suggests conserving tradition. One of the few original foods produced by white settler culture in Australia is the breakfast bread known as Vegemite. It is an aspect of the everyday for many Australians and provides a daily sighting, if not conscious reading, of the homonymic food production American-owned company name of Kraft. Perhaps we might think of the craft of the sandwich or the art of spread toast. Nigel Roberts likens the spreading of Vegemite to painting in his brief scented poem, Soulage at Breakfast, but his poem is a dab in contrast, the tachist smear of Vegemite across the Rye Vita. That's Soulage, so that's like a painted brick, but he does have lots, I don't have any other images, but there are lots of, he has lots of black paintings of various kinds. Writing or painting with Vegemite, we mark out space, blur lines, and cover up the failure of butter to do so. Vegemite is implicated in legal deception too, an ongoing court case examining the Wholesome claims for products that contain trans fats. The naming of Vegemite might be considered a Dada action, as its name was selected out of a hat by Sheila Walker, daughter of Vegemite's first producer, Fred Walker. Its history is further paternalised by its period of renaming as Pa Will in a contest with Ma Might. This alternative name lasted from 1928 to 1935. Vegemite has its maternal aspect too. The Vegemite song contains the lines, "Our mummies say we're growing stronger every single week." It's a nice contradiction between stronger and weak at the end of those two lines. It also has its military aspect. According to a World War II ad, Vegemite fought with men up north. The displacement of Indigenous culture by settler culture is articulated by Ujiru in her poem No More Boomerang, which we've had a reading of already. The form enumerates a range of competing forces. Like Bart's ship, it constantly begets departures. In the first stanza, for example, the boomerang and the spear are replaced by colobar and beer. There is also an implied opposition between shared food, what the hunter brings, and bought things. There is a trend to reification where once handmade objects brought food, now food is a bought thing. No More Boomerang metonymically expresses an end to Aboriginal culture. Yet there is another order of negativity in the poem. The poem does not accept the opposing settler metonyms. Rather, each Aboriginal object is negated by something already framed as negative. A crossed out thing is replaced by an already crossed out thing. In Derridean terms, the poem replaces the boomerang and other elements of Aboriginal culture under erasure, or rather puts the English language under erasure in its attempts to signify these elements. Yet there is also in the poem, I think, a sense of acknowledging the contribution of Aboriginal terms such as boomerang to Australian English, terms that help distinguish Australian poetics from British poetics, while also threatening to withdraw them. The poem concludes decisively with laying down the Woomera and the Wadi for the atom bomb that end everybody. A poetic dialectics is demonstrated where all disagreements are synthesised in ash. The irony is that, for one thing, rhythmically the poem appears to end on an up note as we are blown up, and for another, that this is Ujiru's negation. It is she that says or decides, no more, or her narrator, I guess, as if given the state of things, we might as well all die. The ending also parodies poetic closure in telling us it's the end of the poem. That's all, folks. One stanza reverses the comparison structure of the rest of the poem by citing the settler instance first. Abstract picture now, what they coming at? Cripes in our caves, we do better than that. Isolated, it sounds like a found complaint, one that could be shared with white reaction to aesthetic modernity. Yet the arguable truth of the claim aside, we might consider the abstract nature of the poem itself. The poem is remarkable in that it enacts its own replacement, emptying, displacing its semantic, syntactic displacement with tone, and that one of jokey complaint. I quote, "The paradox is then the achievement of a unity of tone of a settled and remarkably confident way of seeing and judging in the chronicle of confusion and change." This is Raymond Williams' writing of Jane Austen. Hegel writes of the tone as such, without objectivity or form, a hovering over the waters, a resounding through a world. Tone is virtual hovercraft. Through its tone, a poem like Noble Boomerang suggests a relation to poems by other Australian poets, like Forbes, for example, who's also adept at joking about the things he takes most seriously, and whose poems are also often structured via negation, albeit expressing more fondness for his version of modernity. The search for the golden boomerang is just one example. In writing of literature, critics often conflate the terms art and craft. In the English translation of What is Literature, Jean-Paul Sartre distinguishes writing as a craft from the other arts of painting, sculpture, and music. Later in the same essay, however, he writes of this distinction differently. A blacksmith can be affected by fascism in his life as a man, but not necessarily in his craft. a writer will be affected in both, and even more in his craft than in his life. They are synonyms, yet they inflect their context differently. In Google French translation, the art of writing translates as art de l'écriture, the writing, while craft of writing translates as art d'écrire, to write. There are similar differences of inflection when we use the terms writing and write in English. What kind of relation does the use of the word or concept have to poetry then? Does the metaphor relate to the practice of poetry or the making of poetry? Is a poem something to carve or assemble for the marketplace? Emerson writes in a biographical reference to fellow American writer Henry David Thoreau that he declined to give up his large ambition of knowledge and action for any narrow craft or profession, aiming at a more comprehensive calling, the art of living well. There is further ambiguity if we know that Thoreau had invented a new, higher quality pencil. Welsh poet Dylan Thomas, however, negates any professional component to his craft in his poem, In My Craft or Sullen Art, which reverses the art-craft pairing. In the poem, the poet states that he writes for lovers who pay no praise or wages, nor heed my craft or art. That he, in a sense, writes, like Christopher Brennan in his music poem, De Graphoscope, for no audience, is reinforced by his use of the word sullen, which derives from the Latin solus, meaning single or lonely. Japanese poet-sculptor Takamura Kotaro, referring to poetry in the context of carving cicada wings from wood, emphasizes the affective aspect of the comparison. It's thoughtless to make every thin thing as thin as it really is. This is true not only in wood carving, but in sculpture in general, in art in general. A poem which blindly brings an emotion to the surface does not necessarily convey it, but can be coarse and dull. The best piece will be the one that makes you feel that's the way it's made. In Kotaro, the poem is explicitly compared with an object of craft. The feeling is in the beholder-reader. In Thomas, however, the craft appears to be process, work. It is something exercised and laboured. Thomas's narrator also seems to refuse colonising, claiming to write not for the strut and trade of charms on the ivory stages, but the spindrift pages that follow could be the spray in the wake of a boat. The double mention of the raging moon suggests the poems come from the moon via the sea, a variation on American Jack Spicer's poem From Mars that negates the active role of craft for one of a relatively more passive form of reception. Poetess TV again. Contemporary American poet Kenneth Goldsmith proposes that the only craft necessary is three keystrokes: selector, copy, paste. Goldsmith's characterization of conceptual writing practice, which he refers to as uncreative writing, denies the book and the page themselves any meaning as objects, as well as denying meaningfulness to the practice of textual criticism. Yet Goldsmith also lauds the British artist Simon Morris, who retyped Jack Kerouac's On the Road at the rate of a page per day. This project, as described by Goldsmith, is the sentimental one of getting inside Kerouac's head. There is no admission by Goldsmith that what Morris did is any different to what Kerouac did on a purely physical level, though elsewhere Goldsmith relies on the revelation that typing on a typewriter and word processing are different actions. Goldsmith is charmed by the idea that the copy text becomes more meaningful through copying. Yet it seems there is no conceptual road, such as Kerouac's roll of paper. Neither is there any consciousness of appropriation in any wider cultural or political sense, which there also was in Kerouac. The earth is an Indian thing, he writes, and as essential as rocks in the desert, as they are in the desert of history. And they knew this when we passed, ostensibly self-important, money-bag Americans on a lark in their land. They knew who was the father and who was the son of antique life on earth, and made no comment. The reference can conceptually refer to Morris and Goldsmith, who appear to enforce the erasure that the Indians in the text made no comment on. It could be said that through pointing at craft in the sense of the human making of things, that other forms of craft go unnoticed. But what is already made, that is the earth, is disregarded also. Inside Kerouac's head seems to be a place defined by reading history only, place to be colonized for its undifferentiated meaningfulness. To recap, technical aspects of poetry I've alluded to without much elaboration on are tone, tense, the analphabetic, positive and negative space, object as image, Australian language, syntax, punctuation, etymology, fiction, negating structures, poem endings, concrete or metapoetics, the conceptual, and copying. There's just the poems that I've cited if you missed them. I'd like to conclude by returning to the theme of religion. J. Hillis Miller writes that Gerald Manley Hopkins' attempt to rescue himself from language through language is centred on the parallelism between the structure of language and the structure of the creation in relation to the creator. Miller then relates what he calls Hopkins' three apparently incompatible theories of poetry as follows. One, poetry may be the representation of the interlocked chiming of created things in their relation to the creator. Two, poetry may explore or express the solitary adventures of the self and its wrestles with God or its fall into the abyss outside God. Three, poetry may explore the intricate relationships among words. I could point to Miller's use of terms like representation, explore and express and note that they elide how poems are actually made, not to mention where they are made. But what interests me today is whether or to what extent the earth or land might be substituted for God as the primary maker, with the human as secondary, or whether settlers of a secular frame of mind tend to merely substitute the human as primary maker or craftsperson. What is today's narratable truth, its operable diagram of forces? Asking questions is arrogant, but how humble is craft?